Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
You asked the question before about like where to from here, you know, what else from here? And I think it depends on how you've been affected, you know. So, I imagine white folks will, you know, some will have to, some will be, you know, shouting and, you know, wearing party hats. But they will need to grapple with their own conditioning, their own socialization in church that's been historically racist. And then there will be, you know, the reaction of black folk who will need to kind of put all of this into context. What does this mean in terms of what revelation is? And then there are the kind of the offshoots that, you know, the brown, and I'm speaking, you know, as a Polynesian, brown folk who have been affected by this rhetoric because it constituted relationships within the church. So, for instance, you know, as my friend Lani Went Young pointed out, you know, there are Pacific Islanders in the church who talk about black people, you know, who have or, you know, continue to talk about blacks in a racist ways because they're the cursed ones, not like us. You know, we're the house of Israel.
Ah.
So there are hierarchies constituted through this kind of rhetoric. So we're going to have to work that out as well. I mean, I had that in my Sunday school class the other day. Where you know, a Māori woman just couldn't, just couldn't get her head around it because the way she understood herself as a Lamanite or the House of Israel was always constituted as being superior. Mm. So there, you know, and I think for me, the major next step is that we talk about the way the gospel is constituted and understood and languaged in white colonial capitalist terms. There is a way in which a point made by my friend Ganesh. He said, you know, the theological story of Mormonism has been played out in the US. So they don't want polygamy. Polygamy goes. You know, blacks in the priesthood, that was an American problem. That goes. And that has ripple effects right across the world. So it's like whatever is happening in America, and whatever adjustments and cultural adjustments and changes, you know, come in waves out to non-American contexts. And so it's just, you know, for me, kind of the lens is on, well, what is the gospel if it's not American, if it's not, you know, understood and, you know, coming from the United States, from their cultural context. So I would like to see more consciousness about that.
Yeah, you're attuned to lots of things. How would we have those discussions in church? You know, right now the manuals are written that basically, you know, a convert of perhaps a year should be able to handle the discussions that they would lead in there. Where it takes, you know, here you are a professor of cultural studies and rhetoric and discourse and all those kinds of stuff. And, you know, I imagine that there's quite a few in this listening audience that would, you know, study and pray and really work and be able to kind of handle this. But in general, you know, before that level, what is it that you would say could be good intermediate steps? Is it just somebody saying, here's some questions and let it fall where it may upon, you know, rocky or fertile soil? I just don't know how many people could follow what you are doing.
Oh, that's a bit disappointing.
Well, I mean, like I say, this audience probably can. But what do you, I mean, am I being rude, you guys? Not to Gina in this case. but I mean, am I being too disparaging of the level of our gospel instruction on Sundays?
I think you're right on. All of the things that she talks about, the capitalism, American images, what's exported, what's particularly American, the perception of an American, of Mormonism being an American religion, which is a fair perception. I think a lot of that will be taken up in academic circles. Mormon History Association Sunstone, BYU Studies, the whatever symposia they have at BYU. But as far as reaching everybody who needs to be reached, and I always go to my sisters in Guatemala who need to understand that racism is not an issue there. There are the Indians and the Latinos, and they need to understand love, but they do magnificently. So I'm in favor of moving as close to the scriptures as we possibly can, but I am always in favor of telling stories. I sort of didn't say a whole lot about teaching creative writing because that doesn't seem to have much to do with what we're talking about, but I actually think it has a lot to do with it because I am fascinated by people's stories. And I said that my journey that started in 1998 with the race issue, with getting to become an adopted member of Black congregations in Black friendships, that those were not adopted, those are lovely and real, to recognize my sisters and sing with them and learn from them. And that has been so glorious. And I've gotten to tell their stories. I love to be able to do that. I love to be able to tell the life of Susie Mae Young Thomas, who is dead now, to be able to do that in a way where other people can sense it. Jane Manning James, the people who I've gotten to know, that's where I think we really can meet. I would love to have the lessons talk about people, who they were, what they did, what they stood for. We don't have a lesson about Jane Manning James. I'd love that.
Okay, but you're basically saying to get to the issues that Gina kind of, put out there in language that's perhaps too academic, it would be too subtle of points and hard for someone to manage. If the lessons could weave in good stories that illustrated those, we'd at least, that would be our middle ground towards that. Does that make sense?
Now, somebody goes from this general authority said, according to this general authority, and this scripture backs it up. You start paying attention as soon as they start telling a story. So there are all sorts of, and I'm speaking of the global church population, which is not an academic population. I see the full discussion of all of the implications of racism and Mormonism at academic conferences much more than I do in Sunday school. But I see telling the stories of Black pioneers and of the current Black pioneers all over the world as being part of it. Not, talk to the others for a bit, and then I want to add one other thing, Dan.
Okay, well, I was about to, right upon that, I was going to ask Janan and Gina, with Margaret's idea of stories or whatnot, or let's just put you two on a church curriculum committee, and you want to get to these broader issues. Would it be stories? Would that be certainly one tool, or would that be your primary tool as well? Or what would be those ways in order to kind of change the discourse and actually have people think, about, oh, now I do have to renegotiate what revelation means. Wow. Oh, I do need to, renegotiate my own identity now that I recognize this really is an international church and that we have been too U.S. centric and things like that. So what would your committee recommendations be for manuals and whatnot?
Go ahead, Janan.
Oh man, I would that's a loaded question because my first thought would be to include critical race theory.
Yes.
Okay. But isn't there that famous thing that where they wanted to change the use of condoms in South America and they couldn't do it through any other ways, but they put it into the their soap operas? All of a sudden that was a way into the culture that now condom use can go way up because the characters in the TV were explicitly doing this and stuff like that. So if you want to do critical race theory, what's the sixth grade, the eighth grade, the 12th grade level of critical race theory?
I'm having all sorts of unwanted images when I think about curriculum and condoms together.
Oh dear. Okay. I was trying to allude to before just talking about racism and just, I guess, theories on race and how to approach race, definitions that, and it's a difficult subject, including anything dealing with sociology or nothing that is related to doctrine, but I think I think those studies are crucial to being able to understand race in the context of our religion.
Okay, but I want a spiritual uplift at church too. So how are you going to teach me that? How are you going to teach me that theory and help me feel good about the church having resources within its own teachings or within its own history or something for, you know, getting those points across?
I think another important thing that the church teaches is about knowledge coming from God and incorporating that with the lesson.
The big elephant in the room is the fallibility of the church leaders. Once you can kind of negotiate around that, I think you can kind of talk about whatever you want, really.
Because I like that.
You can pretty much start privileging the scriptures. I think this is kind of the where the church kind of wants to move. Like, was it last year the statement came out, like, in which they said, and not everything said by a church leader, you know, it constitutes Mormon doctrine. But that is a huge, huge minefield for people to negotiate. The notion that a prophet would say something that was fallible or, you know, open for discussion or question is very, very difficult. You know, part of our Mormon identities, I think, are very much wedded to this notion of priesthood, or at least prophetic infallibility. But that raises a whole lot of really tricky questions, particularly in terms of the order of the church. And that's one of the questions that I had in my blog post. It's like, okay, right. So they're wrong about this. What else can they be wrong about? And if they are wrong, does that mean that I can just ignore some of the things that they say? And then you've got a problem with control and social control. And then you have a problem with inventive and even speculative theologies. And then you have a problem with, you know, the church sort of splintering off. So that has, but for me, that has to be the first question that needs to be tackled, or the first concern.
Do you see a way in to do that?
It's not an easy one. We had this discussion in Sunday school on Sunday. You know, it comes back to the scripture. You know, the prophet will not the Lord will not allow the president or the prophet of the church to lead the church astray, and that's always sort of like the rationale or the justification for belief in anything that comes out. I think it's Doctrine and Covenants 138 also, whether by mine own voice or the voice of my servants, it is the same. And so there's a way in which God and church leaders are very much paired as sort of a single entity. And to kind of separate them out and say, okay, this is God here and these are mortals here, fallible mortals here. I your question is, do I see a way? Well, you just tell them, don't you? You say, well, they're not the same. God, mortals, not the same. There's a reason he's God.
Yeah, that works. You know, it was interesting. I taught priesthood this last Sunday, and it was Lorenzo Snow's Reflections on the Prophet Joseph Smith. And one of the early paragraphs, it's simply like, you know, here's Joseph Smith. I knew him well. I was impressed with him. He was a person of integrity, etc. And he, you know, he's giving these impressions of Joseph Smith. But he says, you know what? I never went about teaching these things because of Joseph Smith. I went and got my own spiritual witness. I had my own connection with God, and so everything I taught from the Spirit and my own sense of things. So that was at least kind of a way of, like, for him, it wasn't explicit in there, but the way I kind of spun it in my class was, you know, he wasn't claiming that Joseph Smith did everything right. He was claiming about his integrity. He was claiming about the impressions that were made upon him. But when it came down to it, he had to do the spiritual work himself. And so that seems like a nice way in, doesn't it? You know, like, develop your own relationship with God. Then you can see how God works with you. And then you can write that a little bit larger to how God works with church leaders. And you see how you're influenced by culture, you're influenced by language, your own autobiographies, etc. Therefore, these things can work out there. And then you even have a statement like this on race in the church, where these leaders were swimming in curse of Cain. They're swimming in Canaan as the justification for slavery. That seems to me like some way in. Does that make any sense to anybody?
Yeah.
And yeah. I'm wondering, Janan, it seems like what Janan was saying fits in really perfectly here too, about getting knowledge from God. Are you there, Janan?
I'm here, yeah.
I'm wondering if you wanted to elaborate on getting knowledge from God instead of what did the presidents of the church say that are, we go to God as to confirm a revelation or to confirm something that somebody else said, especially if it doesn't feel right to us.
Margaret, actually, I don't even think she said we getting our knowledge from God. She just talked about how the gospel teaches that knowledge is important, and you put that alongside the critical theory, so as a way to let people have their guards down against something academic coming their way. That's at least the point that I thought she was making.
Yeah, just not approaching it necessarily in an academic way, providing information. It's like, this is what has been taught outside the church, and how can we apply these principles or what these theories in a way that coincides with the gospel?
Lovely.
Yeah, I think so too. In some ways, you have to disarm people and those filters that go up when it says, "Oh, okay, here comes the egghead stuff," because you're right. The glory of God is intelligence, and we have a lot of to be learned is good stuff. And even with that, if we could say, "Well, this isn't one of those ifs where somebody's trying to lose their humility or something like that," we're trying to bring the best knowledge that we as Latter-day Saints think that God's involved with all truth and light. It's from God, so here's what it is. So I think you're right there. I think that's a terrific way in.
I have just a couple of comments just about what we're doing now and what will happen after this podcast is up.
Okay, please.
Options that people will have to write comments can either unify or divide. And I don't feel that there's been division among us. We haven't all agreed on all points. But if we're doing things right, we'll do things in the spirit of love and unity. We actually don't need to accuse past church leaders of anything. They had their own journey, and we are on ours. Their journey is not ours. And we don't need to blame them for the faults we have today. We continue to do better. I feel that a whole doorway has opened to us as far as church support for the message that we need to take, that goes beyond all are alike unto God, but all are responsible for all. Each of us has a responsibility to help our brothers and sisters wherever they might be. And the things that the statement talks about, home teaching, the fact that we can have any person of whatever race or ethnicity teach a class to people who aren't of the same. And I think missionary work, where we will pair kids from Idaho with kids from Africa, we'll send them all over the world, they'll learn foreign languages. This is a huge education in unity and learning to become one. And I would challenge those who choose to comment on this podcast to do it in a spirit of love, to not make less of this statement, to acknowledge in whatever way. I realize that there will be some former Mormons who will listen to the podcast who see this statement as something to be denigrated, as something that is perpetuating a white narrative or a lot of white privilege. I would challenge them to do all you can to use this as we must to propel us forward into a way where we can all become more Christ-like. And for those who don't believe in Christ, where we can all become, where we can partake of our divine nature a little bit better. But to do that, we must not have division. I see exactly what the author or authors of that statement saw and why it first comes, that the structure is here in the church for us to have a full unity of heart, for our hearts to be knitted together in love. That's with the way we are structured without segregation, the way we're structured in visiting teaching and home teaching, where we don't just meet each other at church, but we actually go into one another's homes and try to make friendships. That to me is fundamental and such a vital part of Mormonism and the lived gospel. In my own life, I of course do visiting teaching and home teaching, but I've had such marvelous friendships with women who are very different from who I am, and to learn to love them with their differences and to learn to rejoice in the things that they love has enlarged me so much. So I challenge the people who comment on this podcast to do it in a spirit that will help propel the good things that we're all after forward instead of trying to divide us.
I just have a question. So Margaret, do you think, just going from what you've just said, the statements that have been in the past, do you feel that we should just kind of, I don't want to use the word ignore, but I guess I was a little bit confused on, I'll just use the term ignore. Do you think we should just forget what was said in the past and kind of like and moving forward? Or
Some people aren't even aware of what was said in the past, and it it's there in the statement. So if a lot of them have adopted a tradition without realizing where it came from. A lot of people, in fact, I was swimming this morning with a guy in his 70s, and I told him about the statement. And I said, so if you believe in the curse of Cain, drop it. And he said, what do you mean? Of course there was a curse of Cain. And I went to the scriptures with him, you know, there in the pool, and just and said, what do you think the curse of the Cain was? And he said, well, it was black skin, right? No, that's not what the Bible says. That little bit of education, people don't know what they don't know.
Right.
And the statement helps to educate. So the statement itself doesn't tell us to ignore what was said in the past. It actually gives us a vehicle to talk about what was said in the past and then to toss it and then to bring ourselves to a higher level where we knit our hearts together in love. Does that answer what you were saying, Tadan?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to get some clarification on that. I guess for me, it's a little bit difficult to just kind of, I would love to, and just from a personal point of view, be able to move past what was said and how it affected black people. But there are instances, there are occasions where I might be on the tail end of racist thoughts or microaggressions. But that's not necessarily reality for me and for a lot of people of color. So I don't want to stay stuck in this idea like, oh, well, Brigham Young said this and Elder McConkie said that. But I guess I just don't feel comfortable saying, well, we can just move past it and just everything will be fine.
I fully agree with that. And for that, basically, if we were to say move past that, it would be ignore anything bad that happens to you. And that creates such tension and anxiety in anybody. You know, that's an abusive situation. So, of course, there needs to be open discourse. But you will be such a vital part of the conversation, because this statement hasn't taken us to where we need to go. It's only given us a tool to get there better, because now we can disavow with authority the things that have been put forward in the past. So, Janan, mm-hmm. you will be a huge part of what we need to do in the future as you help us have the conversations that we need to have to get where we need to get. People may not recognize, you know, I've heard of people, some of this has bad language, so I'm thinking it in my head and thinking, I can't say that, saying terribly racist things and then saying, oh, I didn't mean anything by it, and thinking that they can excuse themselves by, oh, don't be offended, I didn't mean anything by that. My grandma used to say that. Those are the sorts of things, and I would say microaggressions, that they need to be educated about and say, no, you don't excuse yourself with that. That wounds somebody, and it disrespects who you are and who they are. And that's part of the lived gospel, is to, you know, that's kind of sweeping out the people at the temple who are desecrating the temple. Each human being is a temple and is sacred. And desecrating that space through any kind of abusive language or reference or aggression has to be confronted.
No, I definitely agree. I think there's a lot of power in teaching people, and I also think there's a lot of power in seeking that knowledge for yourself. I think as people of color, we get a lot of questions about what's okay. Is this racist? Is this not racist? You know, can I do this? Can I do that? And honestly, it can get a little exhausting kind of being the encyclopedia of knowledge when it comes to race. So I would hope that maybe even meeting halfway, keep having these discussions, not necessarily relegating discussions about race to, you know, to delegated months, but also members. There's plenty of information out there about people of color, about racism in this country. And so I hope we can find just a common ground where we can talk about these things.
I love that idea. And I would love to be part of facilitating a huge conversation where we can learn, you know, kind of learn the rules, like kind of like you do in marriage. You learn the ways that you settle into one another and maintain the love while figuring out all the little places that aren't quite working. I'd love to have that be a big conversation.
Yeah. You know, what you both have been talking about reminded me a bit of Christine Hagelin had a beautiful blog post by Common Consent where she's using the Lazarus story as an interesting thing to reflect upon here. You know, Jesus, when he raises Lazarus from the dead, Lazarus still comes stumbling out of the tomb and he's wrapped up in the grave clothes. You know, he's still dingy and gray. He probably still stinks. You know, he didn't raise him from the dead where he comes out this bright, shiny being. And Christine's point was, it was left to the people there, his sisters, the family, the community, to confront their own, you know, the taboos about death, the taboos about a dead body, the, you know, the rituals and purities and things here. And it was also up to them to work on bringing him back into the community of living and in a fully, you know, ensconced life within among them. And I thought that was a really important thing. And that's kind of what we're saying here, too. You know, this is a start for us. But Margaret, you're you know, advocate of everybody carry this around with them. Be able to give a paragraph here or there on the curse of Cain or the Canaan is the justification for this, or to be able to say these things and kind of have these in the tools and do the work ourselves to help fully integrate these ideas into the church.
I love that we're talking to people. You know, am I older than you, Dan? I'm 58. How old are you?
54.
Okay, I'm older than you. I love seeing, because Gina looks much younger than I, and Janance is probably old enough to be almost my granddaughter, but certainly my daughter. I love that we are giving the banner to our young people. I plan on working on all of these issues for the rest of my life. I don't plan on dying in the United States. I plan on being in some third world country. That's where my trajectory takes me. But the generation above me, my parents' generation, has to grapple with this because it was so endemic in the culture they grew up in. But the young people are in a much better position. I see such possibility for really getting to the promised land, as Dr. King said and as Moses said, with the generation coming up. I see it in my children, in my grandchildren. My sweet daughter just did not want to stay in Utah because of the lack of diversity. So she's in Indiana. And doing marvelously there. I love the fact that my world has gone beyond Utah to lots of other places, and that my friends have gone into different languages and different complexions. And I am so hopeful. It's you know, I don't plan on dying before I see the promised land. I plan on getting there with the young people, but I think they are the ones who will take us all the way there.
Gauntlet to you, Janan. Thanks, Margaret.
No pressure.
Yeah, that's right. No pressure at all. Gina, what's on your mind as we've been talking here a little bit? We haven't heard from you in a bit.
Kind of going back to that point about, like, okay, so what now? And I'm just sort of reflecting. I'm reflecting on cultural imperialism in manners. And the way in which, because the church is American, it has the rules by which all of our encounters are managed. So my observation is that, you know, having been in both countries and in the United States on several occasions, that there is a culture of politeness. Would that be fair?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, everybody's kind of nice to each other, particularly in Utah. Everybody's like super, super nice to each other. It's quite frightening.
It's because the true church is here. Come on, don't you know that stuff?
Zion.
Oh, it's very sweet. Well, that sounds really, really undermining. No, I don't remember
I'm
that.
I'm just messing with you.
But that's not the case in all countries. And I'm thinking in this particular situation, when you're relieved of a burden of racial pressure, or you're relieved or, you know, you're suddenly informed by some historical or social or political context that you've actually been socially constructed or socialized in a particular context in which you aren't problematic, that the discourses that are around you are problematic, there is always a moment of anger and frustration. And so if we put that beside a culture of just like, let's just be nice to each other, let's all hold hands and, you know, sing hymns together, both, you know, you put that beside this kind of burgeoning and bubbling fury that some people will feel, you know, and about their marginalization. We need to make sure that they're protected in their right to be cross.
Nice.
And really, really grumpy about this situation. And make sure that this sort of, you know, these manners don't interrupt the process of fury that some people get. Like, some people like really problematize fury, but fury and anger and feelings of injustice need to play themselves out. So we can't become impatient with people who are in that moment.
That's really
I like that, but I have questions about it. In writing the books that I wrote with the person I wrote them with, we had a few times where it was down racial lines, where I had gone along with a white person and he felt absolutely betrayed. This is in writing the books that I'll even get specific. He had written a preface and Sherry Dew revised the preface and I said, oh, it sounds fine to me. And my co-author, who's black, was furious that I had done that. You know, I had said he'll need to okay it, but it's fine with me. He saw it as absolutely whitewashed in, you know, what Janan used. And I simply hadn't seen it. I wasn't educated enough. It was new in our partnership. I wasn't educated enough to see what he saw and how that was whitewashing. I simply went along with it. So, in the times when he and I have gotten angry with each other, it hasn't felt like a really good thing. I wish that there were ways that I personally don't like anger. I love forgiveness. I love repentance. I don't like anger. Contention makes me feel weakened. It robs me of the spirit. That's just how it feels to me. So I would love to find a way where we can talk about the things that we have to talk about without, or how do we protect a space for anger and not let it interfere with the rest of what we're doing, and including our spiritual states.
Well, I don't know I don't know that anger is always associated with, you know, people, you know, in the church, we often hear people say, I'm just not feeling the spirit from you because you're not making me feel good. You know, what you're saying is it feels contentious. Whereas for the person who is expressing their frustration, this is a great relief. You know, there is actually, you know, a spiritual process. I think there's actually,
yes.
You know, and this is the you know, maybe there are cultural differences, but there's this kind of process of being relieved of, being listened to, allowing the fury to kind of flower and then shift and change somebody. I just, you know, I think the way we position anger is often, it's often problematized in the church. And, you know, I think there needs to be a way that we need to be comfortable with anger and frustration.
To be honest, I personally problematize it. But I love what you said about having people feel listened to. That one I can respond to. I feel, and I'm thinking as a mother, with children who have not necessarily done everything I wanted them to do, but who I adore. And I respect who they are. And one of the huge things was to transcend the anger and move to, you know, because we got to deal with fun things like drug abuse. And that was part of my process, was to not hold on to the anger, but to transcend it. So I personally don't want to do the anger, but I love the listening to and providing them a space, even if they need to vent. And not allowing myself to turn it into a bonfire. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is that sense of being present with somebody without a timetable, with just love and openness and, you know, the equivalent of just holding them while they sob, you know, whether that's something that happens or not. That's just so much more important than, like, they're there, it's all, you know, feel better, hurry up, you know, just cheer up, you know, that. You know, we got to, like you say, Gina, they have to have the process. And so if we hear that, and I think we're seeing it already in the discussions online, that some of this is going on. And I think in the Facebook threads and stuff like that, I think we do need to honor those that are just saying, this is not enough. It's too little, too late. Here's my story. Here's why I'm out. And we just have to hold that space open for them.
And I'm willing to hold the space open and to listen to the stories. I'm not willing to engage the contention. I'm not willing to fight with them. But I am willing to listen.
Good. I mean, I think that's fair. Is that fair, you guys?
And thinking about anger, a lot of these things, like this doctrine, it's something, racism is something that, well, particularly for Black people, is something that we've had to deal with for hundreds of years in this country, if not in the church, definitely outside the church. So, I've seen a lot of anger. I think it's a bit problematic to tell people how to direct their anger, just because it's such a sensitive topic in the States. So I was just wondering, like, if you guys had any thoughts on that.
I'd love direction on it, because it's an area where I'm not sure. I certainly don't feel that when Darius and I had disagreements, and especially when they were over race issues, that I handled it well. I remember walking out one time. So I'd love better direction on how to do that.
Right, because I mean, and you talk about contention, and definitely that can come up, especially with a topic like this. But I also believe that anger can be transformative. It can be helpful in getting things done. So it's just finding ways to channel that anger.
And how is key. Anger can also be self-implosive. So
yes,
how do we make whatever, and maybe I'm going to just do a semantic variation and call it energy, and not necessarily negative energy, but just energy. Mm-hmm. That energy can come from mistreatment, for finally standing up for yourself and demanding respect. How can we facilitate it so that it isn't imploding, but so that it creates greater, that it becomes transformative?
I think approaching it, center that energy in Christ. I think a big thing is, you know, you have those feelings of resentment or those negative feelings, but also recognizing forgiveness is a big thing.
Beautiful.
Yeah, there's just that somewhere along the line, you know, 10, 15 years ago, whatever it was, I really began to say, you know, I picked up some language along the lines of what is a true relationship? And one of those things is a relationship does not have a specified end. In other words, it's mutual risk. It's mutual, I'm going to affect you and you're going to affect me. That's a real relationship where I don't know where this is headed, but we're in it together and all that stuff. And so for me, when it's an anger that you're receiving from somebody, just don't say that, yes, this is good for you now, but someday you'll transform it, you know. And I'm almost just like, be with it. Model the ability to take it, you know, to recognize that it's not personal. You know, there's largeness that can be powerful in the sense of the biggest person, you know, or the biggest stick gets the most done, but there's also the largeness and who can take the most and not be persuaded. And somewhat to me, Christ is just like, give me your best shot, throw your crap at me. I am willing to hold it and still tell you what love is, you know, through the way I look at you, the divinity I see in you. And so somewhere along the lines, to me, I'm just not quite as worried about giving them words to say, but of course this is, you know, where you should be going next, as so much as it's just like, let me be a steady force of love for you. And if you're going to throw anger at me, even for years and years, you know, I'm still going to be steady. That's more how
I didn't hear Janan say that the anger, that we wait for somebody else to transform through the anger. I think what I heard was that the anger is self-transforming.
I think it runs its own course at some point, right?
Yeah. And I loved what you said at the beginning, Dan, about being there in the relationship and knowing that it is a permanent thing that you're not going to leave. My own personal journey has taken me out of anger because it has always not worked for me. It has always robbed me personally of the spirit. And that doesn't mean that my experience is yours, but for me personally, I don't do it.
Speaking in personal stories, when I first learned of the ban, I learned of the priesthood ban before I was baptized, but then I eventually ended up being baptized anyway. And it wasn't until maybe about 2 years in that I learned that it extended to the temple ban. And when I first found that out, I was very angry. I was very resentful. I didn't understand, like, how could something that I love so much, how could God allow this to happen? But it's in those questions that I had. It is in that, I guess, quote unquote, anger, that energy, that I sought to seek answers to those questions. And so just going back, just anger being a transformative experience, for me, it pushed me towards going towards a place where I felt comfortable, that I felt that I could still be a member of this church and be like, yeah, these horrible things were said, and we're still kind of working through, we are working through issues regarding race, but I do believe that the gospel is true, and I'm going to stick around.
You know, I've quoted before this great podcast from Krista Tippett called Days of Awe, and it's with a rabbi named Sharon Bruce, and she just talks about her own Judaism and her own scriptures and you know, her own spiritual walk. And one of the things that she talks about is she says, you know, it's the pain of looking at the Torah and looking at my people and banging my head against, you know, this was done by my people. This, how could this be? And she says the Torah is made more sacred to her because of her tears shed over this sort of stuff with her. But then she says, I always have to go back to, and this is what you guys were just saying, I'm in this relationship. I'm in a marriage. These are my people. This is my family. And once, you know, she gets to that point in our heart, and I think once all of us get a point in our heart where we're in our marriage or whatever, and we're not always looking for the possibility of divorce, we're not looking to never be with our family again. So at some point, we just get to that place where, yep, this is the history of my marriage. This is the history of my people. This is the history of the crap. But I'm committed to these people, and I'm committed to making it better. And you just move forward from there. And I just think that's a wonderful shift that we can all somehow make. But it takes the work, and it takes those tears, and it takes that hard work of just like banging your head against the wall and say, how could we be this stupid? Or how could I have, you know, expected something so much higher, and I got this reality? And then you just have to kind of grieve it. That this was the reality. This isn't the ideal, but move forward.
Love it. It's beautiful.
Nice.
Well, guys, Gina, we've mentioned the word apology once or twice, and I'll just throw it out to all of you guys. Do we want to explicitly deal with that? Because that seems to be what's on the Facebook threads right now. The main thing missing from this statement was there is no apology for the pain, the hurt, the all the stuff through the years. Have we addressed it enough? We just kind of barely got around the edge of it. Or does somebody want to make a clear statement about that? Gina, I'll throw to you in case you want to go first.
Well, many of the American mainline churches have, over time, you know, particularly since the civil rights movement, made formal apologies for their role in perpetuating racist doctrines. We're about one of the only churches that haven't done it. I think it makes us look churlish. And I think there is something powerful about an institutional apology. I would like one.
Okay.
For my black brothers and sisters.
And Janan, you kind of mentioned somewhere in the thing that you'd like an apology too, but you weren't like, I'm not going to still celebrate this document because it's not quite there yet. Is that fair, or how would you jump off that?
I would appreciate an apology, not for the policy, but how the policy affected the narrative of black people and people of color within the church. I think in some ways, it created this idea that, okay, I'm going to go back to a story. I had gone to a temple, and there was paintings in this hallway, and one of the paintings at the very end of the hallway was this portrait of Jesus in heaven, and there was this light, and it was just an amazing, amazing, moving picture. And he was surrounded by angels. And if you look closely, all of the angels are white.
Yeah.
And I feel like that has been the idea of what Mormons are and Mormons, what they will be. And so I think if an apology does come, I would hope that it comes in the form of, this is how this is how the policy affected people of color, how it did and still does affect people of color, particularly Black people.
Thank you very much. Margaret, one of your blog posts or your Facebook threads with 160 comments or so, the apology question kind of seemed to dominate there. And do you want to go ahead and share your thoughts on that and maybe describe what people were saying or at least how you would handle that?
Yeah, our documentary, Nobody Knows the Untold Story of Black Mormons, actually does include an apology that President Hinckley made to Pastor Cecil Murray when Pastor Murray was in Salt Lake. And I loved Pastor Murray's reflection on that apology, and I loved his response to it, which was, it is true that you, the Mormon people, have played a part in racism, but you've done so much good. And as I heard Pastor Murray's account of the apology, I thought, oh, we're not as good as I wish we were, Pastor. And we still aren't. Of course we're not. We're all still growing, and we are a dynamic church continuing to evolve. But I loved the attitude of President Hinckley. It was not over the pulpit, but I loved the attitude, not of a formal written, we hereby apologize. You can look those up on Google's, but they don't have the lasting effect as much as a church leader taking you by the shoulders and saying, I realize that my church participated in slavery, and a slave who belonged to a member of my church founded your church. I want to apologize for the role my church played in slavery and for the role it played in racism. That person-to-person apology to me is so moving.
But do you see a drawback of the kind of institutional apologies that Gina was talking about?
For me, the statement itself, because I know how far it's come. I know that I have yearned to have a particular repudiation of the curse of Cain, and to have it there and to have it prominently there is huge for me. So one of my blogs I titled, Dayenu, it is enough. It would have been enough if you had only done this. It would have been enough if President Hinckley had only said, how can any man holding the Melchizedek priesthood arrogantly assume that he is eligible, whereas another who lives a righteous life but whose skin is of a different color is ineligible? That would have been enough. But here we have this marvelous statement. So I personally don't see a need for an apology, but I do see exactly what Janan does, and I am sure Gina does as well, which is that we show our repentant attitude, that we show our progress in the way we look, in the way we sing. Not that we're going to turn into Gladys Knight Saints Unified Voices Choir, which we could, but including a few songs like Balm of Gilead, certain songs that will express all of our need to be freed from bondage, but using spirituals, having the hierarchy, and as we have more women in more visible positions of authority, having the complexions be browns and blacks and visibly there, so that it's not, as Darius says, a speck of dust in a sea of cream, but so that it's visibly a global church, that we see that as we look at it, as we look at the general authority charts and all of that. And in the art, I have a picture I'm looking at right now that one of my Zambian friends did, that is of Christ in Africa, and all of the Africans are wearing their, it's a modern piece, impressionistic. I love it, and I want to see more art like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, the only drawback of an apology is just forcing the issue that I think Gina rightly says, and I agree with her, it needs to be addressed eventually. This is, what is revelation? How clear does it come? How much humanness is involved in these things? You know, she mentioned the word control. That wasn't super comfortable for me, is the sense of controlling it, but certainly there is an ease in which you can lead an organization when there's a sense that there's communication that comes that's completely different than any other kind of communication that comes, and there's a sense of why you'd want to privilege that. And so I do think that discourse needs to be had. I think apology falls right into, they're afraid of it because of that reason, but I think we have to get there soon enough anyway. So I'm in the camp of I'd love to see the apology. I know that just Elder Jensen, when he went to the Bay Area and he met with so many GLBT Latter-day Saints, just his weeping with them as saying, I know what we're asking of you is not fair. I know that this sucks. I don't know. I'm between a rock and a hard place, but with every feeling of my heart, I feel for you. I know that that was so powerful for so many people. And, you know, somewhere along the lines, that's the kind of openness that I'd love to see. Whether you call that officially an apology or not, something along those lines at least needs to come soon for me. Guys, anything left? I call you guys. Ladies, sisters.
I really love Dan. I think he did a great job.
Well, thank you. So is there anything left on your tablet, Margaret, that you wanted to share today that you haven't?
No. That's good for me.
Thank you so much for being on. Janan, is there anything left for you to share you wanted to come in talking about and we haven't yet?
Yeah, something that I had shared with Margaret specifically was recentering the focus of the conversations on race in the priesthood on Black people and people who it affected. I think for a very long time, the narrative of Black people within the church has been directed by non-people of color. And now that we have this, we have revelation, we have new information about just, not necessarily about the origins, but just that, you know, that mistakes were made, kind of going off of that and focusing our efforts on how this policy affected people of color on Black people, and then basically working from center to margin as opposed to the other way around.
Wait, moving from center to margin meaning Black persons at the center, radiating out. Okay, good.
Yes, radiating out, yes.
Awesome. Yeah, so again, so through stories like Margaret was talking about, through what, imagine that this was the messaging that you had been given. Imagine that this was a piece of it. What's the ways to do what you just said?
I agree with Margaret, just sharing more stories, anecdotal, just evidence about how this policy affected Black people, centering on what we're doing in the church today, talking about the Genesis group, talking about publications that are being put out by Black members of the church. I love Sisters in Zion. I think they are an amazing example of just of faith and just of giving a nuanced opinion of black people, of Black women, just fostering conversations that are, like I said, that are focused on Black people within the church.
Awesome. Good. I would love it too. Gina, what's your final thoughts if you have anything you haven't left that you haven't said so far?
Well, very quickly, I just want to say thank you to all of those secret squirrels who remain nameless for this statement. I think
nice, the secret squirrels.
It is something, and it's better than before, and I think that's brilliant and wonderful. And I don't want to be so churlish as to dismiss it as not being, you know, enough, because I suppose in the great span of things, there are other conversations to be had, and if those secret squirrels could continue to be working out this conversation and bringing forward these narratives that Janana's talking about and providing spaces for us to really deeply engage with this and heal, I think that would be very, very helpful. I would really hope that that's not the final word.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so interesting that somebody like somewhere in the last bit I've read, you know, it's whatever we see now was begun 5 to 7 years ago in terms of curriculum shifts and manuals and all those different things. And so you hope that this is, you know, something that came public here, but it's built upon a whole lot of other things going on in the background that will be working their way into manuals. And certainly we had the change in the official declaration discussion in the scriptures. And so pretty much from now on, whenever the scriptures are printed, they're going to be printed with those different headings and introductions and things like that. And so I do sense that this is a ship that we're catching sight of it, but hopefully there's a lot more momentum with it. So the secret squirrels, I love that, Gina. Thank you. I do think there's lots of squirrels. It's not squirrely, guys. lots of squirrels doing their thing, and we'll hope for that. And you know, I hope that we prove ourselves ready as a church to receive this, and that, like you say, we don't look like it's just like, hey, you know, the new parent that's like. Not that we're putting ourselves in the parent and they're the children. I don't want to make too much of this analogy, but like, hey, they took their first two steps, but dang it, they should have been running the 100-yard dash by now. You know, we need to make sure that we recognize and celebrate these things. And just like we do in any, you know, we've had a relationship breakthrough and we celebrate it with our spouse that we've really come to a wonderful peace here. That doesn't mean that we know that we don't know that there's more still to be done, but yet we still want to make sure that we do acknowledge it. So I appreciate what you just said there, Gina. Let's celebrate this for sure.
Great.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, Dan.
I loved having you. You're all brilliant. You're just amazing. What God, what a blessing it is. Listeners, please come to the blog. Please share your ideas, your own stories. Tell us the things that we missed out on. I'm sure there's many. Share your own reactions to this as a first step or as a, yeah, it's a bunch of, who knows what you'll say, but like Margaret said, though, let's always try to keep everything that we do, even when we complain or even when we have our moments of anger or whatnot, that, you know, it's for a constructive purpose. So I appreciate that. Of course, when you're at the blog, it's always wonderful to notice up there in the corner that there's these little buttons that say donate or subscribe, and any gifts that you can give in terms of donation, it's tax deductible. It's the end of the year. Get those benefits when it comes to filing in April, but at the same time, you'll be blessing the show, blessing me and my life, and putting the things together financially with my family. But anyway, just I love partnering with all of you in you know, hopefully having these robust discussions. I'll claim that word again, robust discussions about Mormonism. So again, it's just been so wonderful, and just say goodnight to all of you wonderful guests. Thanks so much.
Good night, Dan.
Good night.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.